Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have back as my guest Christian DeQuincy, who is the author of Blind Spots, 21 Good Reasons to Think Before You Talk. Dr. DeQuincy is a professor of philosophy and consciousness studies at JFK University and the dean of consciousness studies at the University of Philosophical Research. If you look back in the archives of Temple of Health, you'll see that we've had several interviews. One of my favorite ones was his book, Consciousness, Angels to Zombies, which is a very, very thorough investigation of consciousness research, which I don't think there's any book out there like it even today. Christian, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, it's my pleasure to be speaking with you again.
So, can you give the listening audience a little bit of your background and how you came to study consciousness?
Oh, yeah. Let's see. Well, I've been a writer and teacher of consciousness now for probably more than 20 years. I've lost track of exactly how long. But I first became interested in consciousness way back when I was a kid. I think I've probably told this story before, but I can give you a brief version of it again. When I was about 7 years old, I was living in Ireland, and one day I was there all on my own. My brother wasn't at home, and it was a rainy day, so I picked up my father's old encyclopedia out of boredom and started flipping through it, and I came across an entry on evolution and started reading and was really, I understood enough to realize that not only did I come from my parents, but that, you know, they had come from their parents and so on, all the way back to the beginnings of humanity, and that humans had come from some prior ape-like ancestors. It had come from some other mammals, it had come from reptiles, it had come from amphibians, it had come from fish and jellyfish, and all the way back to single-celled creatures that book called infusoria, and today we would call them protists or bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So I was astounded at the revelation that my earliest ancestors were bacteria. But more than that, I wondered, well, where in the evolution of species between bacteria and humans did this ability to wonder about anything first arise? Where did consciousness first arise? And so the encyclopedia gave no inclination or no indication of what that answer might be, and then that question stayed with me pretty much throughout my years growing up and into my teens and early 20s, and it came back as an intellectual puzzle probably in my early 20s, and I began to look at it in some depth and started studying evolutionary biology, and I realized soon enough that it wasn't going to address the question, where in the great unfolding of evolution did consciousness first appear? So then I turned to psychology. I figured, well, it's really a question about the mind, about consciousness, and started studying psychology, and then psychology turned out to be mostly based on behaviorism and didn't deal with the mind. So even though it was supposed to be the science of the mind, psychology never dealt with the mind. And so I realized, and certainly didn't deal with evolution, and I realized I'm not going to find my answer there. So then I turned to philosophy, thinking, well, it really is a philosophical question about the relationship between consciousness, between mind and the body, between consciousness and the physical world. Mm-hmm. So I dived into philosophy, modern philosophy, in particular philosophy of mind, and after a while I realized that there are really two English languages. There's the English that we normal folks speak, and then there's the English that philosophers use. And I found it difficult to penetrate the code of philosophy, of Western philosophy of mind, and so then I turned to Eastern philosophy, and particularly Buddhism and Taoism and Hinduism, and was delighted to find a whole raft of documents and writings on consciousness. But again, because they didn't deal with evolution, they did deal with consciousness, but not with evolution, My question still remained unanswered. Where in the great unfolding of evolution did consciousness first arise? And so, in desperation, I returned back to philosophy of mind, Western philosophy of mind, this time determined to crack the code, and I did. And I discovered that the answer to the question, it was nowhere, that consciousness didn't arise anywhere in evolution, not in bacteria, not in fish, not in mammals, not in reptiles, not in mammals, and so on. And that actually it had been there all along, that it was there in the single cells, it was there in the fish, it was there in the jellyfish. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was there in the molecules of the cells. And I realized that that seemed to be the most coherent way of understanding the mind-body relationship, or the relationship of consciousness to the physical world, is that matter and mind, consciousness and energy, always go together. There is no separation between them. And so that became the starting point for my fascination and dedication to exploring consciousness, and went on then to studying at a PhD in philosophy and religion, and have been focused on consciousness studies, in particular the mind-body relationship, ever since. And most of my books deal with that relationship in one way or another, of different aspects of it.
So in your studies, have you come across the concept of group soul for, say, animals versus an individualized soul for humans?
Well, yes, I actually think that the idea of soul is probably more appropriately considered a species, a phenomenon, rather than an individual phenomenon, in that individuals are expressions of a species soul. I wonder why you asked that question. I'm curious to know what's behind your question.
Well, you know, in looking at the type of consciousness that, say, a human has versus a bird has, it's obvious that humans don't swarm in the same kind of migratory patterns that seem to be controlled by an informational system that affects all of them. You know, we don't see humans behaving like lemmings running off a cliff, you know, usually. Anyway, so it seems that there is a little bit of a difference between how animals behave and humans behave in terms of what is the consciousness behind them that is directing them. In other words, the group consciousness has more control over the animal world, whereas humans tend to be more one-to-one with that conscious information coming in probably from another level of existence. Your intuition.
Yeah,
there's an individual intuition.
Yes, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think that that's a very widespread and popular point of view, but I think it's a misunderstanding. I don't think that humans are any less susceptible to group soul and groupthink than other animals are. And we just need to think of the phenomenon of crowds at football games and how they tend to react. I think the current political situation and racial presidency in the United States is another example of group soul, and that could well account for the surge in popularity of somebody like Donald Trump. He seems to be appealing to what I would consider to be the lowest common denominator of groupthink of a certain sector of the population. So there's definitely a lot of lemming-like behavior going on in modern U.S. politics at the moment.
Well, that could be true. So you had this book came about because you were in conversation with people and kept hearing certain phrases being repeated, and then felt that there were blind spots that we were not, familiar with or conscious of in the statements that were being made. Is that right?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, I noticed that over the years, either in conversations with people or with students or emails I would get from people who read my books and watched videos, that people were using phrases, basically cliched phrases, that they just accepted without really thinking through whether or not they made any sense. And over the years, I jotted down notes about these, and then a couple of years ago decided to pick 21, and there's no special significance to the number 21, but I decided to pick 21 of those, and then go into them in detail and write a book about these 21 blind spots. And so that in essence is the genesis of the book, Blind Spots, 21 Good Reasons to Think Before You Talk.
Right. Well, the first one you have is everything came from nothing in the Big Bang, which I've always objected to that one as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, that in many ways sets the scene for many of the other blind spots in the book, because in one way or another, they involve this idea of getting something from nothing.
Right.
So if it were true that the universe began in a Big Bang from nothing, that's an impossibility. That if there ever was a time when there was truly nothing, well, all you get from nothing is more nothing. You never get something from nothing. That's just an impossibility. So the idea that the universe exploded from nothing in the Big Bang is a blind spot, a major blind spot cliche in modern science and cosmology. It's not to deny the fact that maybe about 14 billion years ago there was a Big Bang, but it wasn't the start of everything from nothing. It was basically the continuation of a prior existing cosmos that then gave birth to our particular universe within an infinite and eternal cosmos. So yes, our universe had a beginning, as I say, 13.7, 14 billion years ago, but it wasn't the beginning of everything. It was the beginning of everything in this universe. But before that, there was a cosmos, an infinite cosmos, presumably of an infinite number of prior universes, and there will be an infinite number of universes after the demise of the particular universe that we happen to be part of and have it.
So there is probably quite a bit of evidence for more than one universe, the multiverse theory. Do you agree?
Well, no, there's no evidence for that. I mean, that's one of the interesting aspects of science and mathematics that goes into multidimensional theories. There's no way to empirically demonstrate that. So there are lots of cosmological theories that deal with multiple worlds, but by definition, if they're not part of this universe, then there's no way that we can access them to even confirm their existence. But what's interesting about the rise of the idea of multiple universes is that it actually grew out of the attempts to make sense of the fact that in quantum physics, a quantum event only occurs when it is observed, that is called the collapse of the quantum wave function. And every observation necessarily implies and involves a conscious observer. The idea of an observer without consciousness is meaningless. So somehow or other, we know from quantum physics that consciousness is involved in the collapse of the quantum wave function. But science has no way of knowing what to do with consciousness, because consciousness is non-physical, it's non-quantifiable. And yet, they found that they had to put a place marker in their quantum equations for the equations to work out, and that place marker is the Greek letter psi representing consciousness. Now, because science doesn't know what to do with that and doesn't even have a way of understanding what consciousness is and nevertheless has to include it, a bunch of other theorists came along and said, well, maybe there is no collapse of the quantum wave function. Maybe the quantum wave function, by the way, is a mathematical representation of a set of quantum probabilities. and those set of quantum probabilities collapse into an actuality at the moment of observation. So some other theorists said, well, maybe there isn't any collapse of the wave function, and therefore we don't have to involve consciousness. Maybe what happens is all possibilities, all probabilities do get realized in some other universe. And if that's the case, there is no collapse of the wave function, that all the probabilities get actualized, but each one in its own universe. And so actually, the impetus, the motivation for coming up with this multiple worlds theory, this multiple universes theory, was an attempt to avoid the tricky problem of science having to deal with consciousness. So for those couple of reasons, first, that to ignore consciousness as a fact of reality seems to be the major blind spot in science. All science is dependent on consciousness, and then to ignore it or to try and get rid of it makes no sense whatsoever. And then the other reason that I'm skeptical of the whole notion of multiple universes is that there's no way that we can ever establish any evidence for the existence of any other universe. And so it makes far more sense to stick with the idea of the collapse of the quantum wave function and to recognize that actually consciousness is part of our reality and somehow or other, and this of course is the major question facing modern science and philosophy today, is how can consciousness, which is non-physical, do anything to bring about physical reality? But nevertheless, that does seem to be the way the universe works.
So your second blind spot, which is we create our own reality, is comes out of that.
Well, yes, in some ways I think you're right that became a common cliche in New Age circles and spiritual circles that, well, if quantum physics shows that consciousness collapses the wave function to basically bring into physical manifestation something that didn't exist before, except in terms of possibility or probability, then consciousness plays a role in bringing the physical world into manifestation. That much is true. But then people began to say, well, consciousness creates reality, and therefore my consciousness creates my own reality. And that's the cliche. But if we examine it, makes no sense, because first of all, clearly we don't create our own reality. If we did, it would mean that each of us would be isolated in our own little bubble universe and our own little bubble reality, and we could never communicate with each other. But obviously mm-hmm. that's not the case. We do communicate. And so clearly we exist in overlapping realities at the very least. So we live in a shared reality. But the other aspect is that the idea of consciousness creating reality is also meaningless, because clearly reality existed long before my consciousness or any individual consciousness came on the scene. So clearly I don't create my own reality. There's no such thing as my own reality. If there was, I could never communicate with anybody else. And clearly, not only do I not create my own reality, I clearly don't create reality, because reality was around for billions of years before I arrived at this scene or anybody else did. Mm-hmm. So the idea that we create our own reality is a misunderstanding. However, I think it's attempting to express the deep intuition that I think is correct and that I do agree with. And so we need to rephrase the statement, we create our own reality, with something more accurate, which would be each of us participates in co-creating shared reality. So mm-hmm. there's no such thing as my own reality or your own reality, and I or you don't create reality, but each of us participates through our choices in co-creating a reality that we all participate in, that we all share. So the more accurate phrase would be, as I said, each of us participates in co-creating shared reality, not the idea that we create our own reality. That makes no sense.
So would you say that if somebody has a really, really strong belief system, say, believing that cigarette smoking causes cancer, they would be much more likely to develop cancer if they smoked than somebody who did not have a belief system that cigarettes cause cancer?
Well, no. I mean, we need to step back a little bit in this conversation. If you can fill in the gaps between how you got from the idea we create our own reality to talking about beliefs, what's going on in your mind there? Can you clarify that a little bit?
Well, I'm taking somebody who has a very strong belief system in something versus somebody who doesn't. And, you know, I mean, obviously, you were just saying that we co-create these realities. So what my question is a very strong belief, somebody who really thinks that cigarettes cause lung cancer, is that person going to be more likely to get lung cancer if they smoke than someone who doesn't? What, I mean, is a strong belief going to change their reality?
Well, no, first of all, there is no such thing as their reality. There just is reality. And the second thing...
Their personal chances of getting lung cancer.
We need to make a distinction between reality and our experience of reality. So each of us has our own experience of reality. That's true. But there is only the one reality that each of us has our own little peephole into, if you like. But the reality is a shared reality. It's just the one reality. But the question of beliefs, I don't think beliefs have any creative power at all. In fact, I often say, just half-jokingly, but the other half is quite serious, that beliefs really don't create anything. They never create anything except perhaps trouble. And what I mean by that, by the statement that beliefs have no creative power, is that what is a belief made of? A belief is made of thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what is a thought? Well, a thought is a frozen fragment of consciousness. It's a moment of experience that's like we take a snapshot of a moment of experience, and then that becomes a thought. We're basically plucking a moment of experience out of the ongoing flow of experience from moment to moment to moment to moment. Experience is happening all the time. We don't have to do anything about having experiences. But at the moment we have an experience, we have our cognitive apparatus that kicks into gear and then interprets the experience, and that's called thinking. We have a thought about the experience. And that thought is a snapshot of a moment in time of one particular slice of experience. So it's actually an abstraction from the ongoing stream or flow of experiences. It's an abstraction. And abstractions don't have any cause of potency. So beliefs are made of these thoughts. And what tends to happen is that we have these thoughts and then we construct them into belief systems. And meanwhile, each of us is having an experience. But the beliefs we have refer to experiences that no longer exist. They refer to experiences that have happened some time ago in the past, maybe just a few moments ago, maybe weeks ago, maybe years ago, maybe a lifetime ago, who knows exactly when. But basically every belief, every thought is rooted in the past, and reality is happening right now just at the same time that experience is happening right now. So beliefs don't actually give us access to reality. Every belief, every thought necessarily distorts reality to some degree. Therefore, in my work, I encourage people, instead of relating to other people or relating to life and the world around us through our belief systems, which necessarily distort reality, I encourage people to cultivate what I call experience beyond belief, to pay attention to your experience in the moment, your embodied experience in the moment, your felt sense in this present moment. That's a much more accurate guide to what's going on in reality than to any belief we might have or any abstract thought we might have about reality. So no, I don't think beliefs create anything. They certainly do not create reality. Now, we might have a certain belief system that clouds are thinking and acts like a kind of a filter, a colored filter over how we perceive reality. I want to go back again to the distinction I made a little while ago between reality mm-hmm. and our experience of reality. So yes, our belief systems will act like filters, like colored lenses, that then determine the particular way that we perceive reality. But those beliefs are not creating reality, but basically distorting reality through those colored lenses. So beliefs.
Yeah, that would be.
Yes.
Well, it would be like people who think that all doctors are bad, and so every doctor they encounter, they have that filter and they interpret through that filter.
Yeah, so that particular person, if they have that particular belief system, will then see every doctor through that lens. But clearly their view does not change the reality of whether or not that doctor is good or bad. That's just their perception of that doctor. Yeah.
Okay.
So basically what it does, it doesn't create reality, but it shapes our perception and our experience of reality. And we need to make that distinction between reality and our experience of it.
Well, that's a good point. I think that's probably accurate. So, now you talk about the feelings and how the feelings come first. Is that something that is similar, the feelings shape our experience of reality?
Well, I use the words feeling and experience pretty much synonymously.
Okay.
A feeling is an experience. And so when I say that feeling comes first, what I'm saying is that if we look at evolution, all creatures have an ability to feel, but very few creatures have an ability to think in terms of cognitive concepts. And of course, the species that we're most familiar with that has developed cognition is the human species.
Right.
But in the human species, feeling comes first because each of us, when we're first born, infants have the ability to feel. They can feel the warmth of the sun. They can feel the mother's breast. They can feel pain. They can feel hunger. So infants have an ability to feel, but they don't have an ability yet to think. They don't have language.
Mm-hmm.
And so in evolution, feeling came on the scene long before thought did, and in our own individual development, feeling comes before our ability to think. And in fact, I would say that thinking is a subset, or if you like, an abstraction from our ability to feel. That's why I think it's interesting that even mathematicians, will often, even though they work deductively and logically, will often say that what gave me the clue to the particular problem I was looking for a solution to was that I just felt that such and such was the way to go, and then he or she went about deductively proving what they first felt. So that's what I mean by feeling comes first. Feeling is much more fundamental, much more primary than thinking or cognition. And therefore, we need to have an educational system, we need to have a culture or society that gives far more, that honors the role of feeling as a valid way of knowing in our lives, much more than modern educational systems do, that feeling tends to be marginalized, if not even pathologized, in the modern educational system. And I think that's a great error.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, you talk that consciousness and energy are paired together. Would you like to tell the listeners about the differences between energy? One of your blind spots is energy is everything, for example. But I thought it's interesting how you juxtapose consciousness to energy.
Well, yeah, I begin with a bumper sticker that I often use to try and sum up the nature and the relationship between consciousness and energy. And it goes like this: consciousness knows, energy flows. So energy is what flows through space.
Right.
Consciousness doesn't exist in space. It has no volume. It doesn't have any weight. It's not something you can measure. It's not something you can detect in space. Consciousness doesn't exist in space. It is a different kind of existence. Consciousness is what knows things, objects that exist in space, and those objects that exist in space are made of energy. So consciousness is what knows that energy exists and is what knows or feels or is aware of how the flowing of energy accumulates into various objects. So consciousness is the ability to know, to feel, to be aware, to know things, and to make choices. Energy is objective. It's something we can detect with the senses. It's something we can measure and quantify. We can't measure or quantify or detect consciousness with the senses. So it has a very, very different kind of existence to anything that exists that's made of energy. And, of course, all material objects are made ultimately of energy, some form of energy. Consciousness is not one of those objects. Consciousness does not exist as an object in the physical world. Consciousness is the ability to know any object that exists in the physical world, but it is not itself one of those objects. So consciousness knows energy flows. Consciousness is non-physical. Energy is physical. Energy and all material objects exist in space. Consciousness does not exist in space. So that establishes, at least in my mind, the nature and the difference between these two. But so we have a distinction here between consciousness and energy. One exists in space, energy does, and the other doesn't. Consciousness doesn't exist in space. But that does not mean they are separate. If we look at the different worldviews that attempt to account for the relationship between these two, between consciousness and energy, or mind and body, there are really four options. And the first is dualism, which says that both mind and matter are real, but they exist in separate domains. If we accept those fundamental premises, then we're faced with an insuperable problem, which is to explain how could two radically different things like mind and matter, or mind and body, ever interact? And nobody's ever able to explain how that would happen. So dualism doesn't provide a solution. Next on the scene was materialism, or today what we call scientific materialism, which basically lopped off half of dualism. It says, no, only physical reality exists, and what we call mind or consciousness is something that emerges from the evolving complexity of matter and energy. But then, now we're back to the very first blind spot that we talked about, getting something from nothing. Well, if, as modern science claims, is that the world begins with purely physical stuff, with purely physical energy, with zero consciousness around, then we're faced again with an insuperable problem to explain how it would be possible to get real consciousness from ingredients that have zero consciousness to begin with. That would be getting something from nothing, getting something non-physical from purely physical ingredients. There's no way to explain such an ontological leap from one state of reality to another state of reality, from reality that's purely physical to a reality that now includes physical objects, brains, but also non-physical objects or subjects called minds. There's no way to explain that. So materialism doesn't work. That leaves us with the next one, which is idealism. That's really the flip side of materialism. Idealism says that no, ultimate reality is not dualism, and it's not materialism, it's not matter. Ultimate reality is spirit or consciousness. And this tends to be the worldview of many of the great Eastern spiritual traditions, that everything begins in consciousness, and that what we call matter is something that emanates from pure spirit. But if we look at that statement, it is essentially equivalent to the problem facing materialists, because now you're saying you get real matter from pure spirit. Well, if there wasn't anything physical in pure spirit to begin with, then how do you get real matter out of pure spirit? There's no way to explain that. Then there's another alternative for the idealists, and it's a little bit more, certainly more logically acceptable, is the idea, well, let's get rid of the whole idea of matter and energy, anything physical, and say that all matter is just an illusion, and there is no such thing as material bodies. They are just illusions in mm-hmm. consciousness. Well, logically, there's no way to refute that because we can never step outside of consciousness to say anything about the physical world. So the mm-hmm. claim that that everything is made of consciousness is irrefutable, logically. But it has a different kind of problem, a pragmatic problem, is that nobody who claims that the physical world, the material world, is illusory actually lives in the world in a way consistent with that claim. Everybody who claims that matter or energy is an illusion, wears clothes, eats food, drinks liquids, and so on, they treat the physical world necessarily as real, because if they didn't, they wouldn't survive very long and probably wouldn't stay sane very long. So we are compelled to treat the physical world as real, even while we're claiming it is unreal. So that's called a performative contradiction. A performance in the world contradicts the claim that we make about matter, about the physical material world. So now we find these insuperable problems with dualism, with materialism, and idealism, which leaves the only fourth alternative, which is called panpsychism. And that's the idea that says matter and mind, consciousness and energy, are both real, and they are distinct, but they are never separate. That whenever you have matter, you have mind, and whenever you have mind, mm-hmm. you have embodiment. That mind or consciousness is always embodied in some form of energy, and all forms of energy are always sentient or conscious to some degree. And that, to me, seems to be the most coherent way of understanding the relationship between consciousness and the physical world, and that's what I mean by they always go together. They are inseparable. If they weren't inseparable, then we would be back to the dualism that we began with and try to explain, well, if they are separable, how do they ever come together? So the most meaningful and coherent account of the relationship between consciousness and the physical world is, to me, panpsychism, is the idea that energy or matter is intrinsically sentient, that matter itself, energy itself, has the ability to feel. And so in my work, I refer to sentient energy, that energy is intrinsically, natively sentient. It has the ability to be aware, to feel, to apprehend possibilities, and to make choices among those possibilities. And in fact, that's what accounts for evolution. I sometimes mm-hmm. describe evolution as the sentient energy or sentient matter energy exploring its own potentials. It's the grand adventure of matter energy exploring its own potentials. And so consciousness is active right through the entire process of evolution guiding its unfolding.
So you would say that the planet is sentient as well?
Well, we need to make a distinction between what's called heaps and holes. And mm-hmm. a heap, like a bucket of sand, is a bunch of grains of sand that happen to be in proximity to each other. And then rocks are condensed heaps of sand. And so rocks don't have a unity in the way an organism does.
Mm-hmm.
And an organism is... all its parts are interdependent and interrelated, which is not the way the parts of a rock would be, for example, or a cup or a plate. I just lost my train of thought because something just happened on my iPhone. So you asked if the planet itself has its own sentience. Well, that would depend on whether or not the planet is actually an organism, a whole, or a heap. Mm-hmm. And we've got plenty of evidence, at least to me, some quite compelling evidence from the work of people like James Lovelock and the Gaia hypothesis, that actually the planet as a whole is much more realistically understood as an organism. It has mm-hmm. some kind of metabolism. And if that's the case, then it would have its own sentience. It's not just a heap.
Right.
So, yes, it would make sense to say that the planet might well have its own mind, its own consciousness.
Well, let's switch over and talk about time. Time is, I think you do a really great job in your book with talking about the different forms of time, because time and consciousness are related. I mean, we are conscious of time going very quickly in some cases, and then conscious of time being very, very slow in other cases. So what is time, and how does it relate to our individual consciousness and maybe the collective consciousness?
Well, first of all, I want to make a distinction between time as we experience it and time as it's used in modern science, particularly in physics, mm-hmm. indicated by the letter T, and particularly since Einstein came up with his theory of relativity, general relativity, where he essentially reduced time or transforms time into a dimension of space. But in doing so, basically what he was doing was renaming another dimension of space and using the word time, but completely leaving out what to us is our direct experience of time. So the time in science has got nothing to do with the experience of duration. For mm-hmm. us, time refers to the experience that we endure, we exist, we feel ourselves existing from this mm-hmm. moment to the next moment to the next moment. So time is the feeling, the experience of duration that we persist, we exist from one moment to the next. And that's the true nature of time. Time is something mm-hmm. we have to experience. It's not something that we can measure. People will often say, but that's what clocks do. Clocks measure time. So mm-hmm. if you take a look at a clock, particularly an analog clock, you will see that the hands are moving and marking out areas of space. They're not actually measuring time. They're measuring areas of space that we then mm-hmm. translate into the passage of time, that we correlate with our own experience of the passage and the process of duration happening from one moment to the next. So we need to distinguish between ontological time, which is basically time as experienced, and then psychological time, which is time as perceived or interpreted. So mm-hmm. yes, we can experience, like if we're really engrossed in something, we become unaware of time. A time might seem to flow past really fast or really slow. So we can see that there's a different rhythm to time depending on our focus and concentration. So that's psychological time. It's not ontological mm-hmm. time. Ontological time remains as it is despite what happens in our own psychological time. So let me give an example of that. People who've had experiences, you know, deeply engrossed, that might be in a deep mathematical problem, that might be in meditation, they lose all consciousness of time, and then they arrive at what I consider to be an erroneous conclusion, and they will say that time is an illusion, time doesn't exist, or time can stop. Because I spent the last half an hour and I wasn't even aware that time was passing. So what's happening there is they are confusing psychological time with ontological time. So, for example, when people say that time is an illusion, I say, well, how do you know that? They say, well, you know, in meditation, I had an experience of timelessness. And I say, well, very good. How long did it last?
Right.
Yeah, because clearly it came to an end, otherwise they wouldn't be talking about it now as an event that happened in the past.
Right.
So what happened was, it's not that time had stopped or the time was an illusion, it's just that in their particular consciousness they had lost awareness of the passage of time. The time was still going on, so they were unaware of time during their meditation. But then when their meditation came to an end, time was still going on throughout their meditation. It's just that they weren't aware of it. But then mm-hmm. when they returned to their everyday beta brainwave awareness, they realized time is still ticking away. And so they made the erroneous assumption that during the mm-hmm. time when they were unaware of time, it didn't exist. That's a little bit like, you know, the games that kids, little kids play, and they put their hands over their eyes and they say, well, you can't see me because can't see the world. They assume that the world can't see them. Well, just because we can't have we're not having an experience of time doesn't mean the time has stopped. The time no longer exists. So that's the kind of blind spot that I'm addressing in this book.
Yeah, and that's illustrated in people who are unconscious, too. They have no experience of time going by, but yet obviously it does.
Well, yeah, we would never wake up if our unconsciousness of time meant that time stopped.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly, we go to sleep every night, we go unconscious, we're no longer aware of time, consciously, but our unconscious, our body, our cells are still feeling the passage of time, and our bodies know when it's, you know, through the circadian rhythms or biological, whatever it might be, we know it's time to wake up. And so time still exists even when we are unaware of it. And so just because we are unaware of something, it's an erroneous conclusion to then say that it no longer exists.
There's one other thing I'd like to touch on, and that's chapter 15, Fate or Free Will. Everything is determined by fate or physics. That's the age-old question in consciousness research, I think, is... Do we have free will, or are things fated?
So, yes. Do we have free will, or is everything determined? I think the answer to that is yes. What do I mean by that?
Okay.
That I think everything that's objective is determined, or at least there's a lot of determinism that goes on. So...
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot that goes on in our lives that is causally determined. In fact, we are constantly being informed by the past, by our own past and the past history of the universe. It's impinging on the present and shaping what goes on in the present moment. And technically, that's called determinism. The past is causing the character of the future, of the present moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what modern science thinks is the whole story. But what that leaves out is the present moment also contains a moment of experience. It contains subjects who are having experiences, who have consciousness and have choice in the present moment. And so the present moment contains consciousness and choice, which intersects with or disrupts the determinism of the past flowing into the present moment. So in addition to the determinism of the past, we have the creativity of consciousness in the present moment that can make choices by being aware of current possibilities and then selecting, choosing among those possibilities. And that's what interrupts the flow of determinism. That's why consciousness can be creative, but beliefs, going back to the notion of beliefs again, beliefs are really mental habits, and they tend to act much more like deterministic machines. And that's another reason why beliefs have no creativity. But intention does. Intention is the expression of the essence of consciousness to achieve a particular purpose or aim that we then express in the intention. Something else that that listeners may well be interested in hearing a little bit more about in relation to time, another cliche and blind spot that often comes up is the idea that... that we can read the future, or that the future has some impact on the present. And if you look at that, that makes no sense, because what is time? Go back again to our definition of time. Time is the difference, is the experienced difference between events that have happened, the past, events that are happening, the present moment, and events that have yet to happen, the future. So the future is events that have yet to happen. In other words, it doesn't yet exist. By definition, the future doesn't yet exist. If it did exist, it wouldn't be the future. It would be the present or the past. So by definition, the future doesn't yet exist. Therefore, if something that doesn't exist, it can't have any causal impact on something that does exist. So the future never has any impact on the present, and certainly the cannot change the past. So what then do we make of notions like precognition, where people say, well, I read the future, I was aware of the future, and it turned out to be correct. Well, there's way too many anecdotal and some laboratory evidence to affirm the reality of precognition, of some apprehension of the future. And people tend to think, well, that's reading the future. Well, there's an alternative and, to me, more meaningful way to understand what's happening there. Yes, if we admit the validity of precognition, rather than understanding it as reading the future, which is impossible because, as I said, the future doesn't yet exist, so you're reading nothing. So what then is going on? Well, what I say is going on is that when precognition is happening, it's not that we are reading the future, it's that we are in a particular state of consciousness that is now far more sensitive to attuning into the current quantum probabilities, the unfolding of these quantum probabilities from moment to moment to moment. And so we are getting a feeling for what's likely to happen sometime in the future. It may be just in a few moments in the future. It might be in some cases many, many years or even centuries in the future. But what we are doing is reading probabilities that exist in the present moment. So rather than precognition reading the future, it makes more sense to me to think of precognition as reading deeply into the present moment, into the probabilities that exist in the present moment. So that's a way to make sense of precognition without having to come up with the idea that we are somehow reading something that doesn't exist, namely the future.
I see that could be a good way to explain that.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I said that's a good way to explain that. That's consciousness being somehow expanded in the present moment so that you can more accurately predict what will happen in the future.
Yes, okay. Yes, yes. I think we in certain states of consciousness, we can have a deeper feeling for the unfolding of probabilities and cases that will go right down to a level of quantum probabilities. Mm-hmm. And there's no obvious reason why we wouldn't, since we are made of quanta, there's no reason why we would not be aware at some level of the unfolding of quantum probabilities.
All right. Well, we are coming up to the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Well, I will. I'm just amazed at how fast that went. As we were
it did go quickly.
About the elasticity of our experience of time. The ontological time is saying, well, it is what it is. Yes, people can find out more about my work by going to my website, and that is www.christiandequincy.com. And if they want to find out more about what I'm doing and want to contact me, there's an email link on the website that they can email me from. They can also find some of my writings on my Facebook page, which is Consciousness for Life. And I also put out a periodical e-zine or a newsletter or a blog called IQ Noetic News, and that's something that they can subscribe to from my website as well. So my website is christiandequincy.com. And just to clarify for listeners, De Quincey is spelled DEQUINCEY. A lot of people miss out that E. So it's QEY.com.
And we have previous Temple of Health interviews on two of your books, Consciousness from Zombies to Angels, and also Deep Spirit, Cracking the Noetic Code, which is actually a fiction novel. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
Yes, yeah. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a great conversation, and I've had to think long and deep reading your book. It does make you consider a lot of different things to read this book. So thank you for that.
Well, you're very welcome. And it's been a pleasure having this conversation. Thank you.
Yes, yes, it has. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. We've been interviewing Dr. Christian DeQuincy on his book, Blind Spots, 21 Good Reasons to Think Before You Talk. It's a great book just to consider things like free will, consciousness, time, and all of the things that the questions that we come here to ponder as humans. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.